my face, but I am relieved. This is not about that dead man in the hills. If this were about that dead man up there, this cop would be cuffing me, not bashing Manhattan. I get my bearings as my reactionary adrenaline subsides. "Walking around like you own the place," he sniffs. "Fucking typical." I wish he could meet the nice cop in Rhode Island and see how it's done. People think cops are bad, and this fucker should be fired because of all the good cops out there who follow the rules and risk their lives to serve and protect people. He sneers. "You live here?"
"Yes, sir."
"You live in this hood?"
"Yes, sir," I say. "I live in Hollywood Lawns."
"Then why the fuck do you have a New York State license?" "Are you fucking kidding me?"
"Well," I say, "I'm just here for a little while."
"You a hobo?"
"Hobo?" "No, sir," I say. "I'm a writer." He swallows and I know. This man is an actor.
Calvin gets the same look when someone, anyone with the potential to hire him, enters the shop.
"On a show or some shit?"
"No," I say. "I'm just trying it out." He spins away and I step toward him. "Officer, can I ask what this is about?"
"Did I tell you to move?"
"No," I say.
"And are you deaf?"
"No," I say.
"And are you a fucking tard?"
"Who the hell says that?"
"No," I say. "I'm not a fucking tard."
He storms up to me and gets in my face.
"You think it's okay to verbally assault a police officer?"
"No," I say through clenched teeth.
"You think you're some tough-ass New York scumbag, transient hobo motherfucker, and you can cross state lines and flap your ugly gums at a California state policeman?"
"No," I manage.
"Yeah," he laughs. "I figured you for a New York wigger pussy."
Wigger. This is why they need cameras on police cars, and he finishes writing me up, and it's a jaywalking ticket. Just like Harvey warned me about. I have to pay $375 for crossing the street while the crosswalk was blinking, while there was not a single car in sight. This is wrong, and the motherfucker says he's keeping the headphones.
"Because you're a fucking tool bag," he says. "This city doesn't belong to you. This city belongs to the cars, and you can't walk around here with your goddamn head up your ass."
"That's not fair," I say, but I can't fight with him. Not after I just killed fucking Henderson.
"Oh, and you better go to the DMV and register," he says. "Fuckers like you, showing up here, refusing to register with the state, you're no better than the beaners who think they can just come on over here and take our jobs."
Officer Robin Fincher spits at me as he gets into his cruiser with my headphones. And I picture me joining forces with all the mentally delayed Americans and all the undocumented Mexican workers. We storm the shithole apartment in the valley where he undoubtedly eats egg whites and spinach. He had something green stuck in his teeth. And lifts weights, his arms were unnecessarily jacked, and watches cops. After I get home, I hide my pantry bag in the top right corner of my closet. I shower, I dress, I go to Harvey's office and tell him about this fucking cop and this fucking jaywalking ticket. He chuckles.
"I told you to watch out," he says. "Am I right or am I right?"
Nobody has ever been so ready to leave Franklin Village as I am right now. But as soon as I get into my apartment, Delilah barges in wearing last night's Band-Aid dress. She's sobbing. And she flops onto my futon, hysterical, and fuck, I forgot I blew her off. I go to her and kneel. Mascara paints her face. Tears flow. She shakes. She drops her purse. She yanks the front of my shirt. There is something phony about her sadness because it feels like a display. Like she could have taken a deep breath before coming here. Like she wanted me to see her in this state. "Delilah," I say. "Breathe." But she sobs. I close the door and her teeth chatter and she doesn't use words. She slips out of her pointy shoes and settles into the nook under my shoulder. Delilah, I say, I can't help you if I don't know what's wrong. She rubs her eyes. She reaches into her purse and unlocks her iPhone, 1492, and hands it to me. The headline reads, Henderson House of Horrors. I clutch the phone. Details are scant, but so far it seems like a sex party gone wrong. She leans into me, crying again.
I loved him, she says. I can't. I can't.
I hold her. I stroke her hair. But there is no way I'm gonna fuck her out of her celebrity death depression. If she came to me because her mother died, maybe, but this is ridiculous. She blubbers.
Will you take me home?
Home is upstairs, and I pick up Delilah and carry her into the hallway and into the elevator and over the threshold into her apartment.
Over there,
she says, pointing to her bed, which is directly above my futon. I try to let go of her, but she kisses me, bold.
Make me feel good, she says. Please?
And before you know it, I'm fucking Don't Fuck Delilah. Why not make things as bad as they can possibly be? Why not bang the stalker upstairs?
Joe, she says, open your eyes.
I am inside of her and on top of her, and I look at her. Hey. She pulls me closer.
My mom is coming next week, she whispers. She wants to meet you.
I stop pumping my dick. I'm pretty busy. She grabs my ass.
That's cool,
she says, smothering my neck in Franklin Village slobber.
I get it.
We get back into it, and it's better than it was with Tinder Gwen, and I needed this release after the last hellish 24 hours, but Delilah isn't coming, and I'm ready. Come, I say, and I don't want to meet her mother, and she claws my back, nothing. Come, I say, and I tug her hair, and I bite her neck, and thrust my thumb against her clit. Come, I say, and I pull her hair, and I try not to notice the High School Musical promotional plates on her kitchen counter. Then I get it. She's not coming unless I agree to meet with her mother. She needs the hope of Sunday dinner with me, with her mom, family, fast and furious.
I can do dinner, I whisper.
Delilah comes, garbled and clingy, and I get off her and stare at her ceiling, as unfortunately retro and shoddy as mine. She curls up to me and my arm is in a painful sleep under the weight of her heart, her post-coital rundown of her family. Her know-it-all married sister, her fun-drunk mother, the one who wishes Delilah would just get married, as if that's gonna make everything all better.
You know, you're good, she says. I've been with some pretty famous guys, and you're really good.
I go into Delilah's bathroom, a carbon copy of my bathroom, a windowless vestibule, hell within hell. I take a shit. I don't flush. I leave. An hour later, she texts me.
I love that my bathroom still smells like you.
My television set turns into an international funeral for Henderson. I killed Henderson and nobody knows it, but everybody knows it. America mourns. His brother is in the service, so this means that all the people who would usually take umbrage with coverage of a useless celebrity are on board. Not one bitter assistant comes forward to call him a douchebag. Hours pass. Delilah wants to come over that night. I tell her I'm sick. It's impossible not to search for Amy on TV when the intrusive helicopters hover over Henderson's house, even though logically I know she's not there. Delilah writes back.
Gotta get better for my mom. She can't wait to meet you. Sunday fun day, XX.
I remember telling Amy about my mom. How maybe we would find her and go to dinner. I wanted that the way you crave samosas at 4 a.m. for no reason. I hate love. I hate L.A. Delilah leaves a care package at my door. Kale soup, a Los Angeles Times, and a pack of emergency. I want pizza and a New York Times and coffee. I order a large pepperoni and it's late and cold and dry and overpriced. All the pepperoni fell to one side, and the delivery guy says he could bring another, but it would take hours. Timing is everything, bruh. He's wearing a goddamn R.I.P. Henderson t-shirt, and life moves too fast. I killed him a few hours ago. The delivery guy smiles. I got this at this joint on Vermont, he says. Cool, right? I mean the shirt, not, you know. Yeah, I say, realizing the weight of what I have done. Nobody made shirts for Candace Benji Peach Beck. Those people don't have fans. In trying to assassinate the invisible, elusive Amy, I have killed a celebrity. The others I killed faded away the way grandparents recede into the old photos, or pets just disappear. A famous person never disintegrates from the collective consciousness. Henderson is on TV, on t-shirts. Dr. Nikki Angevine is constantly trying to get out of prison, and his sister-in-law has a website trying to raise public awareness, proclaiming his innocence. The American public doesn't root for a shrink who cheated on his wife with a patient. But they do root for the comedian who set them free, who told them it's okay to be narcissistic, to be a permanent guest. Me, me, me. It would be nice to have something alive to hold on to right now. Something to love me. Something with a beating heart that I can feel. Something to be with me as I sit here in hell trying to figure it out. Am I right or am I right? I say aloud. But there is nobody here to answer the fucking question, and this is why people have small dogs. Why they trap them in their efficient apartments, because sometimes you need another living thing. You need eyes on you. Even if the eyes belong to a fucking Pomeranian. Chapter 15. The people who make it in Hollywood throw their new money north, up in the hills where they settle in mansions where they can look down on everyone. But no matter how big you get, how high your house is, you can't escape from the rats. Rats climb. They're mobile. They aren't bunnies. They don't have a biological drive to burrow. Amy is a rat, scrounging. The kind of girl who bats her eyelashes on her first day of work and wants to know where the Alice in Wonderland worth $1 million is. So of course Amy met Henderson at Soho House. I was wasting my time on Craigslist at Bird's. She got here, she got the fuck out of here, closer to 90210, to Soho House and that wealthy West Side dick she wanted so bad. And no doubt she's still out there looking for it. That Peter Stark shirt is all ratty by now, but I bet she's still wearing it. The traffic is hell and my driver just moved here yesterday, so he took Sunset. You maybe want to take a left, get on Fountain? I ask the driver, the kid. He winces. I'm not really good with left-hand turns, and we have to make one when we get there. Even the kid who just fucking moved here has that me-me-me disease, and I let it go. At least I have an in. While the club is private, they do have events that allow common po-folk like me to stream in. Today, for example, there is an audition for an indie film. The casting call is ridiculous. Second-person cuntiness. You are beautiful, but you are ugly. You are life, but you are death. You are the center and the outskirts. You are a paradox. You are mother and child, and you are the reunion. You are Tara. SAG / non-SAG. Blondes bring headshots. The driver turns on his blinker and I get a pit in my stomach. The idea of seeing Amy after all this time is mind-boggling to think of her mid-hunt for rich dick or possibly here auditioning for this movie trying to be mother and child. Bite me. I emerge from my Uber and I do not take off my sunglasses and I move past the security guy and he doesn't flag me. I am in the elevator. I made it. Three slinky Scandinavian girls pile in with me and they are giggling and they are my ticket, so I smile. Good morning, ladies. The tallest one doesn't blink.
Are you an actor?
No, I say. I'm an agent. They giggle more. The doors are closing, but we are bombarded by two guys who are agents, smug, loud, Muppet men. I told him to fuck off. You told him to fuck off. I fucking ended that before it began, before it existed, before it was in the womb, before it was in my dick, says the Alpha, also in his sunglasses. He nods at the women. Ladies? They explode into giggles. The one who spoke to me looks at him.
Are you an agent, too?
Not right now, honey, he says. He looks her up and down, then looks me up and down. He returns his gaze to her. If this guy is telling you he can make you famous, believe me when I tell you he's lying. His shoes can't make anybody famous. The elevator doors swing open and we are at another roadblock. There is a meager-eyed man at the desk. He recognizes the two fuckers from the elevator and greets them, deferential. The main one whistles with his fingers. Hey, Paco, my shades ever show up? The obsequious servant hangs up the phone and apologizes for failing to find the shades, for failing to find the people capable of finding the shades. He apologizes for being on the phone, and he apologizes for the stairs being slippery, and he apologizes for holding the man back from his meeting, and he apologizes again for not having the shades. The sluts in front of me watch the assholes disappear up the marble stairs. The desk slave sighs and looks at the girls.
Do any of you have a membership?
No,
the lead one answers as she shakes her head.
But we have the password for the audition, for the movie.
He groans.
What is the password?
Aniston, she says.
He waves them on and asks them to take the elevator instead of the stairs. He looks at me.
You're a guest?
I'm a victim, I say. My girlfriend is sick with aspirations of becoming an actress, meaning that she left me this morning to come here and audition, which makes me evil for not following her along to support her. He laughs.
They're upstairs in the main hall.
Okay if I stop by the bar for a drink first? I ask. He nods.
Just say that Ricardo okayed it. I have to admit that I'm sick with aspirations, too.
He whispers and fakes a cough.
Alto, dancer, epic stud.
I laugh, and it feels good to be that guy laughing with the servant as the doors open again and more guests arrive. I leave the blue walls and the art and begin my ascent on the marble stairs. On the second floor, there are lanky, beautiful people lounging self-consciously, stomachs sucked in. I go onto the terrace and see all of Los Angeles, and it looks good from up here. There are small, clean love seats and small, clean people sitting in them. There are beautiful old novels on small shelves. This is the path to Amy. I know it. But she isn't seated at the bar sipping a mojito, and she isn't mulling over dessert, and she isn't marveling at the flowers. I go back inside, where there's a line of doors off a long hallway. I try the first one. It opens and the lights are out, but a woman is sitting in an overstuffed chair facing a monitor. She's barely visible beneath a cashmere blanket and her Beats headphones. Hello, I say, but she doesn't hear me. She is bigger than Beck, but smaller than Amy, and I hate the way my mind puts all girls between those two. I try again, louder. Hello? Nothing. I step toward the girl, and I'm close enough to see the monitor she's watching so intensely. A girl is auditioning for something on the screen. Ah, so this is the girl in charge of the auditions. Hello. Still nothing. I step closer, and now I see her tanned feet, bare, naked, crossed at the ankles. I see her cotton candy hair, and my heart beats faster.
I know her. It's the La Poubelle candy girl who took my water.
Running into the candy girl when I was looking for Amy. This is fate. I touch her shoulder and she sees me. She gasps. There was a study that said all relationship dynamics are determined by the first interaction. Ours is this. Me scaring her. But she is laughing. She gestures for me to sit and I do. Her toenails and fingernails are painted iPhone white. Amy's were painted nothing. And her hair is gathered at the top of her head, falling, a ballerina. She shifts and the blanket slips and her legs are honey brown. More buttery soft than Beck's, tauter, more defined than Amy's. The girl on screen finishes reading and the candy girl pulls a yellow legal pad out of her notebook. She writes, question mark. She holds out the pen and I wheel my chair closer and it's that time before you fuck someone and every single movement is penetrative. My body is all dick. I take the pen. Our fingers don't touch, not yet. I write, I'm looking for someone. I hand her back the pen. Our fingers still don't touch. Who? She has fat diamonds on her earlobes. I take the pen and this time our fingers touch, barely. That wouldn't be fair. She's auditioning. A security guard barges in. She waves him away. It was that easy. She saved me. She is the boss. She motions for me to stay.
I owe you a water, smiley face.
So she remembers me too. I write, La Poubelle. She writes,
Yes.
I write, Yes. She picks up an extra set of headphones and I move my chair even closer and there is sex, so much sex inside everything she does. Amy and I bantered. This is hotter. This is purer. She scratches her elbow and I want to slap my 50 dicks against her elbow. She sneezes. I write, God bless you.
Thank you.
My turn. I'm Joe. You? She licks her lips.
Hi, Joe. I'm Love.
There is heat generated by our legs, parallel, our forearms, close. I write, Love? She covers her mouth with her hand.
My parents are crazy. It's a fun name, though. Like any name after a while, you grow into it and your name is just your name. But then yes, it's weird being Love. Hello, narcissistic asshole, right?
Love is funny. Hello, narcissistic asshole. She smiles and it's on. A spontaneous nonverbal blind date. I crack jokes. Love takes pictures of my jokes about the actresses and texts them to someone. A waiter comes. I write down my order. Cheeseburger, medium well, fries, Grey Goose soda. Love bites her lip and looks at the waiter and makes a peace sign.
Two.
She is an easy breezy beautiful cover girl. I actively promise myself that I will not think of her as healthier than Beck and more fun than Amy. I won't let old broken down dead bad thieving Love be in the same room with new sweet honey legged Love. I am here, now. She snaps her fingers and points at the monitor. I continue to make Love laugh, and when the waiter comes back with our burgers, I reach into my wallet and Love reaches over and grabs my arm. She shakes her head no. She signs for the burgers and I crack up when it occurs to me that everyone knows that sex is better when you're in love. She sees me laughing and she writes one word.
Pervert.
She doesn't look away when I stare into her eyes. Amy would have hit me or squirmed or made it all into a cynical joke. Beck would have pouted and brought up something boring like the etymology of the word pervert. But Love's eyes remain fixed on me and I know. She's a pervert too. Chapter 16. I don't believe in love at first sight. But I do believe in electricity. The way it can recharge you.
I am healing.
When Delilah texts, I write back, went away for a couple nights, visiting my uncle. Love picks up a container of Icebreakers Ice Cubes gum. She pops the lid and offers the box. I open my palm, expecting her to tip it so that a cube rolls into my hand. But she writes,
You can put your hand in my box.
Everything would be perfect if she had used Y-O-U instead of you. I reach into her box and I pull out a piece of the gum. I have learned from our notebook exchanges that Love is a producer on this movie. She is working with some guy, the guy she keeps sending my jokes to. I tell her that I came by to look for my neighbor who was nervous about her audition. Love does that thing girls do when they like you, where they find out you're single and they can't smile and look at you at the same time, so they stare at the floor, and their cheeks turn red and their eyes crinkle, and yes. I write that my neighbor is really tall, blonde. Did you see anybody like that? Confident, Love shakes her head no.
We're looking for someone more petite. I don't remember any tall blondes, no remarkable ones anyway. Do you have a picture of this girl?
I shake my head. But it's fine. It doesn't matter anymore. Her grin widens. All first dates come to a brutal, nasty end, and ours does when a voice blasts into our headphones. It's a man. He is loud and fast. 40 to love, 40 to love, checkity, checkity, breakity, breakity. I write, is that your boyfriend? She laughs. She shakes her head no. That was it. My answer, my prompt, my cue, my yes. I yank off my headphones and Love does the same. I kiss her. She kisses me back. It is the warmest kiss of my life. Love's mouth is Soho House, velvet and marble, members only. I don't try for anything more than this, and I pull away first. She says hello to me, and her voice is at once pornographically suggestive and judiciously blunt, like she has been on trial, been recorded, part of that generation that was instructed to use your words. She shakes her head and laughs.
It's so weird to hear your voice when you haven't heard it for a while.
She's right, and I'm laughing, and she smells so damn good.
Come meet my brother, she says. He's the one who wrote that ridiculous fucking casting call, but you know, he has a vision.
She explains that their parents used to be obsessed with tennis, watching it more than playing it. Love doesn't play much, yes, and 40 isn't much of a jock, who cares? It's funny what girls think you want to know. We walk through the main room and she waves hello to random people. Love is a passport. She's Ray Liotta in Goodfellas and Julianne Moore in Boogie Nights. A hostess. A leader. With her, I can go anywhere. She looks at me before she opens the door marked screening room.
Bear with me, she says. 40 can be a lot.
She's not kidding. The room reeks of cigars and lobster. 40's on the phone and he motions for us to be quiet while he humors his agent. Contrary to popular belief, Philip Seymour Hoffman is not dead. He's alive and well, camping out in 40 Quinn. 40 is bow-legged and blonde, in Madras shorts, a Steve Miller Band t-shirt, with a giant boy smile. Love tells me they're twins, but 40 looks 100 years older. His skin is leathery from sun, cocaine, and court-ordered community service. His hair is the opposite of his skin. Shiny to the point of silken, possibly transplanted from a doll. Yellow and conditioned and parted in the middle.
He's intense, she whispers.
Are you guys close? I ask.
We're twins, she says.
She didn't answer the question, and she tucks her hair behind her ears and begins organizing his mess. We only ordered 2 cheeseburgers and 40 ordered everything on the menu. I try not to react to this mess of wasted food. I will not fuck this up. 40 has a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and he pops the cork off a bottle of Dom. I did not feel the groundlings, girls, he says into the phone. I need more heart in a woman, you know? Nancy is gonna hear from me because I specifically told her, do not bring me funny unless you bring me honey. He hangs up, growling, and Love reels him in.
40, she says in a kindergarten teacher tone. Calm down, it's gonna be fine.
It's not fine, he says. We didn't find her.
We will, she says. But right now, 40, this is Joe. Funny Joe.
40 puts down his bottle, stubs out his cigarette, and claps. Old sport, you fucking cracked me up. I extend a hand and I like this guy, not because he is complimenting me, because he is right. I am funny. I am talented. I am old sport. The three of us settle into club chairs and talk about the actresses, and it's oddly easy. All my life, I've struggled to fit in. I can't stomach Calvin's wannabe posse, and I can't sit with Harvey and listen to him work out his bits, and I could never go through life as Delilah's plus one, but this feels easy. Love leaves to pee, and Forty throws a crumpled napkin at me.
Just be good to her.
Hell yes, I say. So you guys are from here? He looks at me like I'm insane.
Are you serious right now?
I look at him like he is sane. Yes.
He cackles.
He claps.
Dude, he says. I love you for not knowing where you are right now. That is fucking epic.
His eyes darken.
Unless you're full of shit.
God, no, I say. I came here looking for someone and I bumped into your sister, that's it. Love returns and asks what she missed. Forty throws another crumpled napkin at her.
You missed the part where my heart was made whole again, he says. The part where I learned that your new friend Joe has no idea who we are.
Love crosses her arms. Forty, she says. Come on. It's fine, I say. I'm not with the government. Forty laughs too hard. And Love picks up the napkin and throws it away, even though she doesn't need to do that.
You have to forgive my brother, she says. He's deluded sometimes, and he thinks we're famous, but we're not.
But we are, he says. Joe, you ever hear of the pantry?
Best grocery store ever, I say. There's one right by my house.
In Brentwood? He asks.
No, I say.
Santa Monica? He asks.
No, I say.
Dude, you full-time it in the boo? He asks.
I live in Hollywood, I say, in an apartment building. Forty steps back, and it's like at school when they find out you get free breakfast and lunch.
Cool, he says. Hollywood, if she could, right, bro?
Our parents own the pantry. Love says, and my mind is blown, and I don't try to hide it. Which does not make us famous.
Everything is hazy as Love and Forty squabble over whether or not they're famous. I can't believe Love owns the pantry, my special place, my haven. Ray and Dottie have been trying to send me their love since the day I got here.
So, will you be joining us and the moms and the pops at the Big C? He asks.
I look at Love and she smiles at me.
We're going to Chateau, she says. Will you come?
Sure, I say. And it was on my list of places to go, but I don't want to act like a fucking tourist. Forty strokes his chin and stares at me, and Love asks what his problem is, and he sighs.
I'm gonna guess that our new friend doesn't have a jacket, and I'm gonna suggest a pit stop along the way to amend this unbearable injustice. Yes?
I look at Love. I say yes. Chapter 17. I'm at home in Love's Tesla, and I was born for this. We pull out of Soho House, and I show her my pantry playlists in my phone. My Shazam search history, too. She wants to see my most played songs, and she is perplexed.
This is a lot of stuff from Pitch Perfect, she says. Do you have a girlfriend?
I tell her she's funny, and I make up some shit about watching it on Netflix in the middle of the night and liking the swimming pool mashup. Then I bring it back to us, to the pantry playlists.
I just can't get over it, I say. I love those playlists. I go in there just for the music.
She gets all excited and her knees bump and she drums her elbows on the wheel.
You don't understand how I'm about to blow your mind, she says. I make those playlists.
And she's not kidding. My mind is blown.
Love is the music designer, and she is the person letting Valerie by the Zootons melt into Gregory Abbott. nobody ever notices, she says. And I mean, I think about this music. I obsess over this music. I think it's because of my name, but I have like 10,000 pictures of me posing in love songs. Like, Stop in the Name of Love, you know? Me in front of a stop sign.
I think it's okay to touch her and I pat her knee. Don't worry. Your dorky little secret is safe with me and I'm not going to jump out of the car. She has so many different smiles. This one is impish.
You can't. She says, you're locked in.
Good, I say. She put me in a cage already. I tell her I love the funny names the pantry has for each section.
I named those when we rebranded, she says. I came up with Procrastination Nation when I was in college freaking out about my thesis.
I can't believe this, I say. I ask if she studied drama in college and she tells me she's not an actress.
I mean, I don't think you grow up here without thinking about it, but I have a charity called Swim for Love, where we give lessons to at-risk kids. That's my main focus. These movies 40 and I try to make never come together, which is fine, but I'd rather do that than audition. Wasn't it so sad?
I tell her my zombie aspirations theory, that fame is the antidote, the issue of supply and demand. She says I sound like a writer and I say I'm a bookseller. But enough about me. Tell me about the pantry, everything. She says her great-grandparents helped build California, one pantry to start an empire, and now they own dozens of markets in California. They own acres of land and malls and holy shit, the girl is loaded.
I'm not telling you to tell you, she says. I mean, I'm not bragging.
I know. I say. And I mean it when I say I would be excited if you only had the one store. I love it there. She laughs.
I'm starting to get the picture. And we have to thank your friend, the one who auditioned.
She taps my shoulder.
The reason we met.
Love is bold. Love is horny.
We should send her flowers. Or candy. What was her name again?
Nice try, I say. I'm not telling. She slaps the wheel. I laugh. I still can't believe the way your parents have been telling me about you, and I had no idea.
Well, that send our love thing, that was my dad's idea, she says. My parents, they're kind of grossly in love. And after I was born, after we were born, my dad was like, let's spread the love. Let's make that a part of our everyday.
I think it's sweet. My parents hated each other, and our grocery store had fucking rats. She has a loose, high laugh. She says that Ray and Dottie are middle school sweethearts. Dottie's father was a butcher. Ray's father owned the pantry. They fell in love as children, stayed in love as teenagers, and they're still nauseatingly in love now. I laugh. Love says that I won't be laughing in an hour when we're all at Chateau together.
It's just not normal, she says. It's like they never got over each other. They act like they're in high school.
That's unusual. Love says it kind of sucks and sighs and says she believes in laying it all out there. She blames her parents' happiness and her given name on her proclivity for relationships. She's been married twice.
Twice?
I ask. I hold my phone up to the window. My service is bad and I want to Google her.
Use my iPad, she says. The password is love.
The password is love. And I pick up her iPad and she tells me about her husband's. She met Michael Motorcycle in Vegas, total asshole. And she was young and stupid and resentful and on blow. They lasted 11 months. 11 months, I say. That's impressive.
You gotta try,
she says, and sometimes I can't tell if she's being earnest. She married her second husband, a black doctor named Dr. Trey Haynes, 8 years ago.
He was my heart.
I go into Safari and look at her search history. Boots, puppies, boots, snow boots, puppies, labs, chocolate labs, black dog booties, over-the-knee boots, yellow labs. I don't see how this can be it. Maybe it's some rich person privacy setting where no matter what you look up, it just says boots, puppies. Because the girl searching for boots and puppies can't be the insightful woman here in the Tesla
the one telling me about her marriage to Trey. We were both 27, she says. We were crazy in love.
Boots and puppies.
Uh-huh. But then he got sick. Cancer, she says. People always talk about the fight, but Trey didn't get to fight. We didn't get to, you know, I didn't have the chance to clean him up after chemo or shave my head to go along with his.
He died that fast, I say. And maybe boots and puppies are a defense mechanism.
That's horrible. It wasn't cancer. He drowned when we went surfing right after he got diagnosed.
She grips the steering wheel more tightly.
My mom would kill me if she could see me right now. She says I talk about this stuff way too early. But you know how your brain has sort of a baseline resting thought? A thing you talk about with yourself?
Mug of urine, Candace Benji Peach, Beck Henderson, mug of urine.
Yeah.
Well, mine is always about Trey, she says. I think he killed himself. I think he felt so bad about me having to watch him die that he killed himself. And not in a coroner poison kind of way. I mean, did you ever read Flesh and Blood?
Yes, I say.
Well, you know the guy who's gay and he can't deal with it and he swims out to die?
Yes, I say again, and I can't believe Boots and Puppies is talking to me about Michael Cunningham.
Well, I think that's what Trey did, she says. He couldn't handle the idea of me and my family dealing with it. My parents are all about good things, but bad things,
she shakes her head.
Is this too much? Should I put on some music or something?
I hold her hand on its way to the dash.
No,
I say. So is your brother married?
Ha, she says. That's our family joke. I was married twice by 30, and my brother can't even date one girl for more than 5 minutes. The best role models can be the worst role models.
Love tells me that it's impossible to live up to Ray and Dottie's relationship. She doesn't even know why they had kids. They're so in love with each other.
You hear about moms being like, fuck my husband, I love my babies now, she says. And my mom, I mean, she loves us, but she loves my dad so much more. Are your parents together? You said they fought, but some people, that's just how they communicate.
Ah, rich girls. No, my mom left. They weren't a model for anything.
If only you got to choose your model, she says. But we get what we get.
Love is 35 now, which will make her the oldest woman I've ever slept with, and I realize how badly I do want to sleep with her. She uses her blinker. She is kind. She says she's sort of also from New York.
We have a couple places there, she says. But I never last more than a few months. It sounds lame, but I think I'm just too sensitive.
How so? I ask.
Love grew up mostly in Malibu, but was homeschooled with biology trips to the Galapagos and immersion semesters in public schools, and she loves Los Angeles. She used to want to be a lawyer.
This is a problem we have, she says. A family thing. My dad is like,
I got these two kids, and one wants to make movies, and one wants to defend the bad guys, and nobody wants to run the shop.
Is that how he really sounds? She slaps my leg.
You'll see.
Love doesn't believe in bad people or good people. She believes in people. Her September 11th goes like this. Love was in her first year of law school at NYU.
And in all honesty, I hated it, she says. I wasn't getting along with anyone, you know. I was in my room watching Legally Blonde, wanting it to be more like that. And I mean the bad part, when Elle Woods doesn't even have any friends. I was miserable.
Weren't you a little young? I ask. Love is 5 years older than I am, many years older than Beck and Amy. But she is not that old.
Well, she says, remember, I was schooled independently, and my dad, well...
Her voice trails off, and I suspect a lot of her stories have holes filled by money.
So I was up all night at this divey bar, whining to my friends about how I wanted a sign.
A sign? I ask.
You know, she says, a sign that it was okay to leave law school.
She honks at someone who tries to pass her.
And then we're still fucked up, just walking it off, and it begins. The towers, the hell, and the world goes insane, and my friends are like, holy shit, there's your sign.
Wow, I say. I will not judge her. Instead, I think about her nipples.
Please be horrified, she says,
mind reader.
I realize how asshole-y that all sounds. To say it was my sign? It sounds stupid and selfish and solipsistic to say that September 11th was my get-out-of-law-school-free card.
That's harsh. Beck had to look up solipsistic in the dictionary. Amy did not own a dictionary.
But when you're young, you need all that validation, and you read your horoscope, and you say things like, if the guy at the bar gives me two cherries and not one, it means I'm supposed to leave this bar and go somewhere else.
I get it. Love wants to know where I was on September 11th, and we are stuck in the shitty part of Sunset where it's all strip malls. I tell the truth. I got in trouble at work. Mr. Mooney locked me in a cage in the basement. I missed it. By the time I got out, the smoke was clear.
Wow.
She drums on the steering wheel. She says she loves eccentric people. She loves old people. She loves a good story. She says we have really good September 11th stories and that we can make a good movie out of them. She likes the idea of a New Yorker who missed New York. She asks how old I was. 16, I say, too quickly. She laughs. I want to eat her candy pussy.
Joe, she says, one thing about me, I don't give a shit about age. I'm not one of those girls. You can be younger than me all you want.
Her mother calls and Love talks to her about tennis balls and net jets. I can tell that Love likes me by the melody of her voice, by the way she tells her mother she's bringing someone. When Love finishes up with her mother, she zips into the valet at Hollywood and Highland.
Will you think I'm a horrible princess if I say I can't deal with this traffic and I'm dying for a drink and I would rather just get you a jacket somewhere here?
I don't think Love is a horrible princess, and I don't let her pay for my clothes at Lucky or The Gap.
Almost ready? Love asks.
Almost, I say. When I emerge from the dressing room, Love is wearing new clothes too. A tiny little white dress with slits on both sides.
Wow, she says. I can't believe that jacket's from The Gap.
I can't believe she's wearing a nightie to dinner, but I'd rip off the tag like she asks. My mom always said, the rich are different. Chapter 18. I live here now, at this particular table, on this particular night, at Chateau with these particular people, my people, the Quinns. I am born again a Quinn, unofficial son-in-law of Dottie and Ray, the Dottie and Ray who send me their love at the pantry, and they know how to hug, how to talk. They are round, happy people, and we talk current events, and they don't understand the hoopla about Henderson. I'm old school, Love's father declares. Give me Johnny Carson, or Jay Leno at his desk. Hell, I'll take Jimmy Fallon because the kid dresses well, but don't give me this punk on his couch.
Dad, don't be so harsh, Love admonishes.
No, I say. I see where he's coming from. I think Henderson was poisoning us all. There's honor in asking people questions. There's honesty in it, curiosity. It's intellectual. Earlier generations, they were more comfortable as listeners, and Henderson promoted an idea that we could all be the center of attention all the time. But if everyone is on stage, who's in the audience? Everyone stares at me. And this has happened a couple of times tonight, when I questioned the value of organic vegetables and expressed my opinion on kale. But I own them, and I win again when Ray claps. You are a breath of fresh air, Joe. Dottie beams.
So smart.
Love rubs my thigh, and she is right. Ray and Dottie do seem in love, and they love me. Ray wants to know if I like boats in Cabo because he's got a new Donzi he's dying to get in the water in a place in Cabo. La Grosseria, he says, enthralled with his terrible accent. The neighbors, they thought we were nuts, but I like a good name. Why shouldn't I call it La Grocería? Everything sounds better in Spanish. I googled Donzi. It costs around $500,000. Ray and Dottie insist I eat and drink whatever I want. Your first time at Chateau is a special thing, according to Ray. Lives are made here, Joe. This is the mothership. This is our family tradition, and when you're with us, you're family. You understand? Love laughs him off, but he is right. Chateau Marmont is a country that doesn't allow extradition. A safe zone, a haven, and everybody cares about me. Is my chair soft enough? Is my drink to my liking? Is it too hot, too cold? Do I need a heat lamp? Do I eat shellfish? I have never been so nurtured, and love whispers, my parents, not so bad, right? And I have a new respect for aspirations, because this is a great way of life. 40 breezes in and hugs me like we're best friends. Ray huffs. You see all those girls today for your audition, but somehow your sister is the one who comes away with a new fella. 40 brushes it off. She's got the love, Pops.
Your father and I just want to see you happy, Dottie adds.
I know, Mom, 40 says. And I assure you, when I finish casting and finalize the rewrites and get my agent the bio he needs for that pilot shooting in Sedona and get him the rewrites he needs for that other pilot shooting in Culver, I assure you, dearest parents, I will meet a very nice girl and get married and pop out two perfect children. Maybe even twins. Love laughs.
You're horrible.
But 40's not done. Because it's very easy to meet available beautiful babes while I'm heading up 5 projects at once. He knocks back a shot of tequila. But tonight, to Mom and Dad, on Dad's half-birthday. In my navy blazer over a plain t-shirt, I pass as one of these people at Chateau. Ray tells stories about the good old days, running around the first pantry, working double for pennies. His parents gave him nothing, that was a different time. And Dottie says the past is the past. She says you can't pretend you have nothing when you have so much. She squeezes my arm.
See, his father was the owner, and my dad was the butcher, so it's only because of me that he knows what it was to be poor.
I understand, I say.
Of course you do, she says. You're from New York.
Love keeps her hand on my inner thigh. This is a family, and Ray and Dottie like me because I work for a living. I could live like this, but Westward Ho is by definition about expansion, and our party is larger all the time. Friends come by this half-birthday party, and Love has to go be nice. 40 slaps an arm on my back. You don't work in the business, right? He asks. No. I confirm. I get a kick out of it, though. Your notes were of value, he says. He tears into 3 packets of artificial sweetener. Which is precisely what this business needs. He wants a high five, and I'm there, and he's talking about Almost Famous, and he vents. People here don't like to think. They're afraid of it, like, if they do it, there's no turning back. But you're a thinker. You're like that statue. I can tell. I see that. Thanks, I say. Ray leans in. He's a professor. 40 nods. And this is a nickname I can handle, the professor. And Love returns, dangles her arms over me, and whispers in my ear. Professor. No, I say. It's the professor. Ray claps, and here comes our unofficial guest of honor, producer Barry Stein. Everyone rises for Barry Stein, and then Bradley fucking Cooper, Chateau, is hugging him, inviting him to sit. And now Barry is coming for us. He's so West Coast that he could have been in Ocean's 11. He wants us to sit. He doesn't smile. He's too cool to smile. Dottie is devastated that he's come on his own. The wife and nanny are in the dumps over Henny, he says. And that's a new one. Henny. He switches gears, not unlike Delilah, and slings an arm around Love. But Dottie, if it pains you to see me all alone, I'll gladly take this one right here. Fucking pig. But Love's father laughs, and Love excuses herself for the ladies' room with a kiss on my cheek. Stein sighs. All the good ones are taken. Dottie smiles.
This is Lovey's new friend, Joe. He's brilliant.
Ray endorses me, too. This kid's got the goods, Barry. Barry says it's nice to meet me, and I don't like him, and I don't like the rich blonde motherfucker approaching this table. His hat says Vineyard Vines, and his t-shirt says Four Seas Ice Cream. And when I wanted to come here in a t-shirt and jeans, we had to go shopping. Love returns from the restroom and hugs this man.
Milo, it's so good to see you.
The waitress makes room for him, and Dottie kisses him and invites him to dinner, and 40 elbows me.
Don't waste your time turning green, he says. Milo is just our brother from another mother.
I tell 40 I'm fine, and then I'm on my feet, extending my hand. Milo opens up for a hug.
Fuck that, he says. Bring it in.
Milo's eyes are too big, his smile pandering. He's overly gracious with the waitresses, too complimentary of the cake that Dottie got for Ray. He's a fucking liar to the bone. He's a television producer.
By trade, he says, but my heart is in the theater.
I want to know if his dick has been in Love. And she says that he's way too self-deprecating. All people have a blind spot. Love's is Milo. She doesn't understand that he deliberately undersells himself so that she will gush over him.
Milo is amazing, she raves. Unlike me, he stayed in law school.
He looks down bashfully, and immediately I know that they were fucking on September 11th. Love goes on.
And Milo isn't just a producer, he's the producer. He's the reason New Blood Connecticut won all those awards. He just knows so much.
Milo smiles.
The lady doth exaggerate. Please, be a friend. Tell me about you.
But Love cuts me off.
Joe, she says, Milo is also a fantastic writer. He's just back from Martha's Vineyard, where his movie played at the festival, right?
Actually, it was Nantucket, he says.
And I think Uncle Barry might have had a hand in that. And it's just a short.
I look at Barry Stein, who just shakes his head.
All I did was watch the movie, officer, I swear.
We all laugh, as if this is funny, and it isn't. And Milo tells everyone about his short fucking film, and Love pays attention to him, not me. I'm not involved in this conversation, and I slip away to find out a little bit more about this fucker. I go online and learn that Milo is Barry Stein's godson, not his nephew. I learn that he and Ben Stiller posed for photos together less than 24 hours ago. I learn that his short is a based-on-fact retelling of the most searing event of Milo Benson's childhood, when his older brother shocked Darien, Connecticut by murdering Milo's father, hedge fund owner Charles Benson, in cold blood. Fucking Republicans. They kill each other over money, and then the liberal boy left over takes all the cash and makes a career out of repurposing this one event from his childhood, first into a book of drawings, and then into a Vanity Fair essay, and then into his TV show. I head back to the table, where Milo and 40 fight for the attention and approval of Barry Stein, who says Milo's ideas have tremendous potential, but pats 40 on the back and tells him that his ideas need work. These are two very different statements, which is idiotic because at the end of the day, either you have something or you don't. Milo orders an acai bowl, and 40 orders a Patron double. I nudge 40 and tell him that last idea sounded good. 40 nods, and Ray raises his glass.
To family,
to food to fun, to the fast and furious.
Ray and Dottie are proof that money can buy happiness, and 40 groans.
Dad, enough with those movies.